Everybody, welcome to this Catherine Centre event, International Women, Peace and Security Agenda, Australia's Leadership on the Security Council. My name is Sarah Joseph. I'm the Director of the Catherine Centre, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here today. I must start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet today, that is the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And I'm going to introduce you to Professor Jackie True, who is going to be the chair of the night. Professor True is a professor of politics and international relations at Monash University. She is a specialist in gender and international relations, feminist research methodology, and violence against women globally. Her book, The Political Economy of Violence Against Women, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2012, recently won the American Political Science Association Prize in 2012 for the best book in human rights. Will you please welcome your chair for the night, Professor Tripp. Professor Jackie Tripp.
Well, welcome everybody. Just bear with me and I'll just change the overhead slides here. Can you help me with that? Just pull the other one up. Well, welcome everybody. It's really great to see you all out here tonight, and we're so pleased to be kicking off the first of the Australia-wide events on the International Women, Peace, Security Agenda, and in advance of Australia's presidency of the United Nations Security Council next month. So I really would like to thank you for coming and participating on behalf of Monash University's Faculty of Law and Faculty of Arts. I'd also really like to thank the civil society organisations who have helped to promote this event. In particular, I can see Joe Hayter over there, the International Women's Development Agency in Melbourne, Y Wilf. Who's a Y Wilf person here? Yes, great. Nice to see you. And also Young UN Women. Who's from Young UN Women here? Fantastic. Okay, great. And also Oxfam. Is anybody from Oxfam here? Okay. So all of those networks we've been closely involved with. This event is inspired by the Women, Peace, Security Academic Collective, and it's connected to the similar events in Brisbane tomorrow night, in Canberra on the 27th of August, and in Sydney on the 30th of August. And so WIPSAC really was formed about a year ago, and its main purpose and mission was to build productive collaborations between academic researchers, civil society advocates, and policymakers in Australian government, and internationally, in particular, to progress, challenge, and extend the International Women, Peace and Security Agenda. And because we are researchers and located in universities and teaching students, we also felt it was one of the key purposes of our work to promote awareness and knowledge of women, peace and security issues. But also, more importantly, I guess from an advocacy perspective, or where advocacy and research meet, to hold the Australian government accountable for the commitments they made during the campaign to have a non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council, in which they were very strongly advocating Australia's commitments to advance women and peace and security, and we want to continue to hold them accountable for what they do during the two-year non-permanent membership on the Security Council that began this year in January and goes through to the end of 2015. Okay. So because I couldn't assume that everybody knows what is this Women, Peace, Security, and I was counting on Mr. Noel Campbell from the International Organisations section of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to kind of himself introduce the topic, I'm going to do that. I have an apology from DFAT. As soon as the government announced the election on the 7th of September, they immediately cancelled all public engagements related to the UN Security Council presidency. But I'm going to say a few things about what Australia is doing during September in New York City. because I think it's really important that we follow what Australia's doing and we hold the government accountable for how they are promoting and advancing the international women, peace, security agenda. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what is the women, peace, security agenda and what progress has been made over the last decade and this year, and how Australia has been planning to lead this agenda during the non-permanent membership of the Security Council. And finally, I want to talk about the role of research and introduce the three speakers tonight. The structure of the forum tonight is that each speaker will speak for about 15 minutes, and I'll try to keep within my time limit also. And then we'll have an open floor discussion, which I'll chair. And then at 7 o'clock, we have drinks and nibbles, and we hope you all stay around to talk further and maybe join the Women, Peace, Security academic collective. Okay, so just a little bit about the background. So the Women, Peace, Security agenda, which it's now called, is a way of talking about a series of six Security Council resolutions. And that began in October 2000 with Resolution 1325. It's the only Security Council resolution to have grown an advocacy network to specifically promote the implementation of that resolution. And so it's a really fascinating resolution to follow. It was subsequently followed up by 1820, 1888, 1889, 1960, and just 2 months ago in June, Resolution 2106. Okay, so we talked about all of those as the Women, Peace, Security agenda, and what that adds up to is at the highest level of the permanent and non-permanent members of the Security Council in the United Nations, recognising that people experience conflict differently, and in particular, the experiences and differences within conflict and post-conflict affected societies, those differences are particularly significant for between men and women, men, women, boys and girls. And so women experience conflict differently than men are often impacted differently. And that's really important if we're going to think about how we should bring about lasting peace after conflict. So the other aspect of the Security Council resolutions and the Women, Peace, Security agenda is that women have an essential role in conflict prevention at the local level through to the international level in peace building and in post-conflict reconstruction. And more recently, and I guess since 2008 in particular, it's been very clear at the Security Council level with the recognition of rape and sexual violence as so-called weapons of war, that there is no impunity for conflict-related sexual violence or sexual and gender-based violence more broadly. Okay. And we commonly talk about the pillars of the Women, Peace, Security agenda, and those being the three P's. In WIPSAC, we talk about the four P's. So we talk about the prevention agenda, which really relates to the prevention, linking violence and the prevention of conflict to existing policy priorities. And that's really important if we're thinking about the inspiration of the agenda coming from especially the Women's League for International Peace and Freedom and where we are concerned with really eliminating conflict and violence, okay? And so here what's salient, and it's been salient this year, Australia having played a role in the Arms Trade Treaty and acknowledging that the flow of small arms and light weapons are enablers for war crimes, for criminality and for gender-based violence. Okay, wherever we have small arms, we have heightened vulnerability to gender-based violence. The protection agenda is also about this protection from violence, but here, I also think this is an important aspect of Australia's role in so far as Australia has a commitment to Afghanistan in the transition period and the withdrawal of the ISAF troops. And here, Australia can really play a role in upholding and protecting women's rights, particularly in Afghanistan. The participation agenda is the one that's supposed to be highlighted by Australia in its presidency next month. And here it's particularly linked to women's leadership and peace building and moving forward the 7-point plan or agenda from the UN Secretary General, which was outlined but hasn't been. And what it outlined is the failure to fully implement the Women, Peace, Security agenda. And here in particular, Australia is seeking to highlight the lack of holistic approaches in integrating expertise and gender-sensitive programming on the ground in conflicts, the lack of attention to gender inequalities and economic recovery, the lack of concrete monitoring and accountability mechanisms within peacekeeping and peace-building operations, and the lack of gender sensitivity in planning security sector, economic and justice reforms. So there's a number of things there. The fourth pillar, which WIPSAC adds, is really about the structural conditions for lasting peace. And that relates to the broader gender, social, economic, and political inequalities. And here, we think that Australia's focus on peace building and drawing connections between the UN Peace Building Commission and the UN Security Council is really, really important. And an important opportunity to also highlight how post-conflict exacerbates the structural inequalities between men and women. And in that context, we often know that greater marginalisation, greater gender-based and sexual violence is experienced even after the political settlements or so-called formal resolution of conflict. And so, again, recovery from conflict must be governed by commitment to the Women, Peace and Security agenda. So Australia has said they're going to lead. They said that in their original campaign for the Security Council in the document called Australia, We Do What We Say. So it's nice to remember that. Yes, we do what we say, but sometimes we don't, thanks to politics and elections and caretaker governments. So what Australia has in fact, actual fact, planned for September is a side event on September 6th, the day before the election, so you'll probably be remembering that because our local media will be swarmed with Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott. Meanwhile, in New York, we'll be hosting civil society, peace building, gender experts from member state delegations to talk about women's roles in conflict resolution and peace building. We're very much hoping, and I know that people have been lobbying very hard to be sure that our region is represented there and that we have civil society representation from Australia and the Pacific. So finally, I'd like to introduce the speakers. I guess what I would say is that the hope was that Australia would really focus on women's equality and agency in peace building, and to ensure that women are actively represented right throughout the peace process, from being able to participate in peace negotiations as active members and to shape those negotiations and their outcomes, and also to be able to participate in conflict resolution, prevention, and the recovery of societies. And I think what's highlighted by all of the research that we are doing, but in particular the three researchers tonight, is that their work really highlights women's agency, that women are not just victims of conflict, differentially affected by conflict than men, but they're also agents of their own destinies and in reshaping their societies, even though they may be disproportionate victims. For instance, Sharon will be talking about how women and girls are much more likely to die crossing borders than men due to entrenched gender inequalities in every society, but particularly in conflict societies. And what is in common, I guess, to all three researchers is that their work is informed by feminist methodologies. And what marks out feminist methodologies, whether in law or social science, is that they do pay attention to women's voices, and they pay attention to gender differences and to non-traditional agents of change as we're trying to bring about peace and security for everyone. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Ronley Sefris now from Monash's Faculty of Law and the Capstan Centre for Human Rights Law. And she's going to speak about the centrality of gender justice not only in the prosecution of recent war crimes, at the International Criminal Tribunal, but also in post-conflict recovery and in the creation of lasting peace. So thank you very much, Ronnie. Okay, good evening everybody. As Jackie just said, my name is Ronley Sifris. I'm a lecturer with the law faculty here at Monash and also an associate of the Caston Centre for Human Rights Law. The Caston Centre has done a lot of great work in this area, and we've held a number of events which have focused on conflict and post-conflict justice. So for example, this year we held an event focusing on Southern Sudan, and last year we held an event focusing on Sierra Leone. Also, I should mention that a number of law faculty academics research in this area. So there are a number of academics researching in international criminal law and also transitional justice more broadly. And I myself am teaching units at both the undergraduate level and the master's level, which focus on post-conflict justice. But this evening, I want to talk about the justice component of the Women, Peace and Security agenda. And I want to talk about the link between gender justice and women and post-conflict peace and security. So when most people think about justice, they think about the concept of justice in the traditional legal sense of the word. So they think about prosecutions or criminal trials. Prosecutions do, of course, have a very important role to play in achieving post-conflict justice, but in the post-conflict context, we really need to look at justice in a more holistic, restorative sense of the word. So in addition to talking about prosecutions, we also need to talk about truth-telling mechanisms like truth commissions. We need to talk about reparations programs, programs which compensate people for harm that they've suffered. And we need to talk about institutional reform so that rights abusing institutions become rights respecting institutions. And when we talk about gender justice, we really need to look at all of these mechanisms for achieving peace and justice through a gendered lens. So I want to begin by talking about prosecutions, and then I want to move on to look at the other mechanisms for achieving peace and justice. From a gender perspective, I want to briefly talk about two decisions. And the first decision is a decision of the ICTR, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and the second decision is a decision of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. The first decision is a decision handed down by the ICTR in 1998. Just by way of background, the ICTR is an international tribunal which was established by way of a United Nations Security Council resolution. And it was established to prosecute the perpetrators of serious human rights abuses committed in Rwanda. And the case I want to talk about is the prosecutor versus Jean-Paul Akayesu. And this case is significant from a gendered perspective because of the way that it approached the law relating to rape in conflict. So historically, sexual violence which was committed during conflict was viewed as a crime of honour rather than a real crime. And it was viewed as a crime against the honour of the woman who was the victim, and significantly a crime against the honour of the men in her life, like her husband or her father, for example. Decisions like the Akayesu decision helped to facilitate a shift in mindset. And today, crimes of sexual violence are viewed as grave enough to constitute genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, depending on the circumstances. So let's talk about the Akayesu decision to demonstrate this point. Jean-Paul Akayesu was the mayor of an area in Rwanda when the Rwandan conflict broke out. There's a photo of him up there on the slide, obviously, after he'd been arrested. And he personally supervised and orchestrated the rapes and murders of a number of Tutsis who lived in his area. With respect to the rapes, the tribunal found him guilty of genocide and crimes against humanity. From a gendered perspective, the case is significant for a number of reasons. First of all, it is significant because the tribunal recognised that in certain circumstances, rape can constitute torture, genocide, or crimes against humanity, for example. So the decision clearly removes rape from the crime of honour paradigm and puts it squarely within the real crime paradigm. Secondly, the decision is also significant because the definition of rape invoked by the tribunal didn't focus on penetration and it did not include lack of consent as an element of the crime of rape. By not focusing on penetration per se, the court emphasised the reality that rape is about power and control. It is not just a sexual act. And by focusing on the conduct of the perpetrator rather than whether the victim consented, the court made it clear that there are certain circumstances, such as circumstances of conflict, in which coercion is so apparent as to completely negate the possibility of consent. So to sum up, the Akayesu decision was significant in its framing of sexual violence as a real crime, rather than a crime of honour, and in its progressive definition of the crime of rape. I now want to move on to look at a decision of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. The Special Court for Sierra Leone was established jointly by the government of Sierra Leone and the United Nations, and it was established to prosecute the perpetrators of serious human rights abuses committed in Sierra Leone. And this decision is significant because it broadens the understanding of the types of harm which women may suffer, from a narrow focus on sexual violence to a much broader focus on other forms of harm. So this case involved the prosecution of three leaders of the Armed Forces Revolutionary Council, the AFRC, and you can see there are photos of all three of them at their trial there on the slide. And these three leaders were prosecuted for crimes committed in Sierra Leone. And the case is particularly interesting from a gendered perspective because it brought questions relating to the crime of forced marriage to the public consciousness. So whereas 10 years previously, the ICTR's Akayesu decision was significant in terms of how the crime of rape was perceived, this decision of the Special Court for Sierra Leone addressed questions of forced marriage. At the trial, the court refused to determine whether the crime of forced marriage had in fact been committed. It took the view that the crime of forced marriage was subsumed by the crime of sexual slavery. So there was no need to consider forced marriage separately. The issue was appealed, and significantly, the appeals chamber held that forced marriage is distinct from the crime of sexual slavery, and that it is not necessarily a sexual crime because sex is not the only incident of a forced relationship. So in other words, the crime of forced marriage is broader than the crime of sexual slavery. And on this basis, the appeals chamber held that the trial chamber had incorrectly classified forced marriage solely as a sexual crime. It had incorrectly found that the crime of forced marriage was subsumed by the crime of sexual slavery. So this marks a significant turning point. The recognition of rape as a war crime, as a real crime, which we saw happen in the Akayesu case, was significant because it was symbolic of the move towards recognising crimes of sexual violence as real crimes, not just crimes of honour. The move which we saw the appeals chamber make in the AFRC case was significant because it demonstrated an understanding of the reality that women may be victims of gender-based offences which are not wholly sexual in nature. So these two decisions which we've just discussed are examples of significant developments by international tribunals. But as I mentioned earlier, to achieve true justice, peace and security, it is necessary to look at the concept of justice from a broader, more holistic, restorative perspective. So I want to spend the last few minutes talking about some other transitional justice mechanisms besides prosecution. First of all, I want to talk about truth commissions. A truth commission is a temporary body. It is set up by the state to investigate a period of human rights abuse and to compile a report detailing what happened during that period. Typically, people give statements before a truth commission, and these statements then help to inform the truth commission about the truth of what happened. So if the truth is being told by people whose perspective fails to take into account the difference between men's and women's experience of conflict, then that truth is likely to be gender biased. Traditionally, when women have appeared before a truth commission to testify, the focus of their testimony has been on either the harm done to the men in their lives or forms of sexual violence which they have suffered. There's been little focus on other forms of harm which women may endure, or on the different types of roles which they may play during periods of conflict. For example, a woman by the name of Yvonne Kutwane testified before the South African Truth Commission, and she revealed her history as a political activist. She described the arrests, imprisonments, solitary confinement, and interrogations to which she was subjected as part of her struggle against apartheid. She also revealed that she'd been raped by a police officer. Despite the fact that her history as an active participant in the struggle against apartheid was clearly a core part of her identity and her story, it was the rape which the commission highlighted in its final report. So this clearly didn't do justice to her story, which was really about much more than the rape. So what this demonstrates is the importance of recognising the myriad of roles that women may play in periods of social and political upheaval. Reparations represent another mechanism for achieving justice in a holistic, restorative sense of the word. As the name suggests, the key purpose of reparations is to repair damage caused by wrongdoing. Traditionally, reparations have been directed at providing redress for violations of civil and political rights. So, for example, they've been directed at providing redress for violations of the right to be free from torture or violations of the right to liberty. This is problematic from a gender perspective because women are disproportionately victims of economic, social and cultural rights, such as the right to healthcare or the right to education or food or housing. So when it comes to looking at reparations, and when we're looking at reparations from a gender perspective, the starting point needs to be that reparations need to cover violations of both civil and political rights, as well as economic, social and cultural rights. The final mechanism that I want to briefly mention for achieving peace and justice in a holistic sense of the word is institutional reform. And in many ways, this mechanism is the most relevant to the aim of promoting women's leadership in peace building. Looking at institutional reform from a gendered perspective, the idea is that for women's rights to be respected and protected moving forward, women need to have a voice. They need to have a seat at the table. So key institutions like Parliament and like the armed forces and the police forces need women in powerful positions to bring about a change in culture and to make sure that women's rights and interests are properly represented. This is in fact not just an issue for post-conflict societies, but it's also an issue that we need to grapple with here at home. The other day I was watching an episode of the TV series Veep, some of you may have seen it,
And in this TV series, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who many of you will know as Elaine from Seinfeld, plays the role of Selina Meyer, Vice President of the United States. And in one scene, Selina marches into the office of the President's senior strategist, and she demands more recognition and more responsibility. So I have a quick clip of this, which I hope you can hear, because we've had problems with the volume. Sorry, but she's basically saying that she wants a seat at the table, and anyway, it's better if you hear her say it. So I'll leave my presentation there, and hopefully we can have a fruitful discussion about all of this afterwards. Thanks so much, Ronnie. It's so annoying when the multimedia doesn't work. But what's fantastic about that clip, and you should search for it on Google, is, gosh, I don't watch Veep, I'm a bit too old. Seinfeld was my thing. But Elaine, so to speak, says, well, if you're not at the table, then you're probably on the menu. And what's so interesting is when I saw that clip, I thought, I heard that at the UN last year. Women from the Middle East and North Africa said made precisely that point using exactly the same language as the TV program. So it's a really good example about how there is a kind of global discourse really trying to promote women's participation and right to have a place at the table. So thank you so much, Ron Lee. I'd now like to introduce Dr. Leslie Pruitt from the University of Melbourne. Leslie is a McKenzie postdoctoral fellow at Melbourne, and she's going to speak about some terrific research she's been doing on a strategy the UN has more recently adopted, which is to put women at the forefront of the peacekeeping and security sector by sending all female peacekeeping troops from one region, in some cases, to another region. Leslie's going to tell us all about that and evaluate the impacts of that gendered strategy. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. As Jackie said, I'm going to talk to you a bit about my research on these all-female form police units and use that as kind of an example to talk about a broader context of obstacles and opportunities for women's participation in digital. Interestingly, as I'll get to, some people at the UN don't want to take UN credit for this at all. And there's quite a lot of difference between whether people think this is a good idea or not. So I'll get onto that some more. But basically, this is an ongoing research project of mine. It started with an interest when I read an article about the deployment of these women in the news several years ago. I began by doing a discourse analysis of how they were looked at in the media in India. And then I did interviews with former and current UN officials in New York and via Skype. And my next step is going to be fieldwork research that will be conducted in India in October of this year and in Liberia February and March next year. So really open to all the comments and feedback you may have on me for me as this develops. So women have participated in peacekeeping in both military and police capacities in a number of ways for a number of years, but they've always made up a quite small percentage. In 2007, the first all-female form police unit was deployed from India to Liberia. That group was made up of 105 female members from India's Central Reserve Police Force. They were recruited from around India, and this is particularly a paramilitary force. We have special experience with quelling riots and these sort of really hand-to-hand training in combat and martial arts. Charlotte Anderholt has described that unit as experimental in being such a first for the UN. However, the UN has not referred to it publicly in that way. They were deployed to Liberia following their 14-year civil war, so they had a really big task with ensuring peace and security in this region. What's interesting, especially, is that their introduction saw major gains in the number of women, percentage-wise, in a mission. So for the UN policing overall, women make up 8.2%. However, in Liberia, where we've had this ongoing all-female unit, they make up 16.67%. So it's actually more than double the numbers overall otherwise. And that group in 2007 was seen as very successful, and they've been replenished on an annual basis, so a new contingent comes in and rotates every year. In 2010, another FFPU, or All-Female Foreign Police Unit, was introduced from Bangladesh to Haiti. However, there's been much less publicity around that group and also much less public information available. So in this research project in particular, I'm concentrating on looking at the Indian unit. The implementation of these FFPUs has come about in a period in which, at least on paper, gender has been gaining continuously greater attention in discussions around peace and security. We've seen lots of resolutions, lots of public statements saying we need more women, we want women at the table, we want women participating in all aspects of peacekeeping in equal numbers. One UN DPKO staff member I interviewed even called this a golden age of gender mainstreaming, she said it was. It's like amazing. I just want to put that in context to still remind us that women still make up only 3% of military peacekeepers and less than 9% of police peacekeepers. So while we may be in a golden age compared to previously, we've definitely still got a long way to go with our notion about getting women equal seats on the table. Now, I'll just put this up and I'll let you read through this yourself because it's a very long list, a very big mouthful of the many, many prospects that the UN has said that can come from women's participation in peace building. So these range from highlighting the UN's commitment to gender equality to creating a space where women can report crimes of sexual violence against them in conflict to reducing conflicts and confrontations. I'll just give you a moment to take in quite how much we're expecting that women can do when they get into these roles. And I think there are really valid reasons why we do need more women in peacekeeping. But a number of scholars have started to criticize the basis for some of the claims that exist around why that is, asserting that many of them are based on essentialist or stereotypical notions of what women naturally are. And I looked at that and found some around that in the discourse analysis that I conducted before, so I'm happy to give you that link later. But in short, you know, assuming that women are the natural peacekeepers is probably part of our problem, which we can get to that more. And female peacekeepers also face a number of challenges. If we look in the broader context at the aims to get them more involved in gender-integrated forces, where they're usually a very small number or a very tiny percentage of the contingent, and those need to be given consideration, these issues that female peacekeepers in those roles face. So, as it's been pointed out by research, they often face a double burden of trying to meet these really high expectations while they themselves are often facing dangers of sexual harassment and abuse from both local forces and their own colleagues, as well as assumptions that they ought to mediate conflicts occurring between males and their own forces, that they ought to police the males of what they're doing in their own forces. Research with Australian peacekeepers in Timor had women police officers reporting that though they were highly trained, skilled, and experienced in the local context, for several of them had the experience when deployed in Timor that they were told by their own colleagues, "Oh no, we'll handle that, ladies. This is a bit too dangerous for you. We won't be having you doing that." And so this is what some researchers have noted as a hyper-masculine environment that is constructive in peacekeeping and that's often not very welcoming to women. And they have real impacts or detriments potentially for their long-term career progress and goals. For example, a former formed police unit coordinator from Liberia I interviewed told me about how a Nigerian contingent that he worked with had 20% women, which was seen as, like, this is really great, 20%, and that's amazing. But as they were still a small number relatively in the overall group, they were tasked with cooking and cleaning. So while they were deployed as peace officers, or police officers, what they were actually doing is cooking and cleaning. So you might imagine the impacts that might have if they're going for promotion or other jobs down the line, and this is the kind of experience they can refer to as having security. As opposed to, in the case of the all-female form unit, which interestingly actually has some male staff who do cooking and administrative work, the women are all in charge of doing the security. They are out on the ground dealing with riots, protecting officials, and training local police officers. So through the interviews that I conducted, I wanted to learn, firstly of all, about how did this FFPU come about. It seemed quite novel. And I think that's important because at the UN, when I was there was actually no institutional memory. Nobody there knew how it happened. They had no idea. So it was really a lot of snowballing, trying to find someone who knows someone through colleagues, through UN officials. And I was finally able to interview Mark Croker, who is a former UN police advisor, for shorthand I might say the UN's top cop. previously. And he said he had sort of taken this as a personal cause of his. He was especially inspired through his daughter, who's an LAPD officer, and the sort of challenges she faced. And he really wanted to encourage more women to get involved and to be a public advocate for that and all the roles that he held. He gave lots of presentations. And he said after one of these, he was speaking to some people from the Indian Permanent Mission who mentioned to him that in India there were some different ways that women were involved in policing, and some of these included these all-female units. This had never occurred to him before. He was really interested and said, do you think we could get some of these units to actually deployed in peacekeeping? This would be great. And he says from there he gives all credits to the Indian contingent who really went away, went back to the country, and developed and deployed this group. Now, while there were actors like Mr. Croker who were championing this cause, there were also a number of doubters. And I think they fall into two different categories. There's the one group who said, wait a minute, we don't want women. What's wrong with this? This is not women's job. But then, interestingly, there's another group that maybe what we might call a liberal Western notion of feminism, a certain preferable model about gender mainstreaming. And for both of these groups, the presence of an all-female unit incited a number of gendered fears. So some of these were around women's roles and capacities, and others were around what constituted good or real participation by women. This is particularly interesting, as one staff member at the DPKO said to me, she was very suspicious and quite uneasy about this group, and she said, well, I think it's artificially inflating the numbers of women. I was a little bit confused by this because I was thinking these are actual women with actual boots on the actual ground. But there's this notion that I'll get to more about appropriateness. And then there were also these naysayers who were on the ground who didn't want them deployed because they didn't want a group of women coming. And this was something that the local foreign police unit coordinator, who was also a man, had to deal with the different commanders and try to get them on board with this. And I think this goes back to Cynthia Enloe's point around how people become very uncomfortable when women's assumed femininity is called into question when they're taking on traditional wartime roles. And also leads into Stephen's point that with troubling frequency, gender is used interchangeably with women, conflating the two and leaving men as the unmarked default category, the generic human against which others are compared and potentially deviate. And I could see this very clearly in this case when Croker, the former police advisor, said, When I brought this up and said this was happening, the discussion was there, and the idea of the FFPU emerged. The question was immediately, can the Indian government actually produce it? Do they have the right equipment, qualifications? Is the mission willing to have them? The question started coming, are you sure an all-woman unit is really appropriate? Which is quite interesting, because up until this point, most of the units were all male, and no one was ever asking, are you sure an all-male unit is really appropriate? So this gets into these really interesting questions around logics of appropriateness in terms of global culture or the normal environment around peacekeeping. We can look at authors like Roland Paris, who says that peacekeeping organizations tend to focus on a logic of appropriateness even if it conflicts with the notion of effectiveness. So it's the question of these two don't have to be separate, but can we think of them together? So there is this suspicion of gender segregation in all forms, that people were saying this is not a good thing. Although some who worked with them on the ground did in fact say, you know, this is an important step and these women are doing great work and should be recognized. For many people, even though they're doing great work, I don't like it. What are we doing? Why are we letting there be this all-women unit? This is not what we're going for. And I think that's because it challenges some of the existing norms around gender mainstreaming or what it should look like. So gender mainstreaming has been understood as the UN's major tool for better including women. It's the process of assessing implications for women and men of any planned action, including legislation, policies, or programs in all areas and at all levels. A strategy for making women's as well as men's concerns and experiences an integral dimension of the design, implementation, monitoring, and evaluation of policies and programs in all political, economic, and societal spheres so that women and men benefit equally and inequality is not perpetuated. So that's a mouthful. And it's been criticized by some as being abstract and interpreted in varying ways. And I think in this case we can see how it can sometimes be problematically understood through a lens of women adapting to fit into existing institutions, to follow existing norms in gender-integrated programming that was created with men's needs, abilities, and interests at the forefront. And I think if we look back to some of the obstacles that women face that I mentioned before in these mixed gender units, we can see why there might be some quite legitimate reasons why some women might actually be more apt to want to deploy in peace teaming or to take on these roles if they had this as an option for an all-female unit. I don't think this necessarily solves these problems more broadly, but it, at least in the meanwhile, ensures that these women are getting to do security roles, which is what they deploy to do. Their career is as police officers, and therefore might impact their opportunities and advancement as well. So I think we can potentially think of it as a temporary special measure alongside other efforts at gender integrated forces. So just some key points here. Is one, I think the efforts at including women in peacekeeping can be limited or stalled by strictly adhering to these certain ideas about appropriateness, about gender mainstreaming, if we're not at the same time critically engaging with what other alternatives might be available or how we might enhance effectiveness. And number two, I think getting more women in peacekeeping and increasing the impacts of those women who are already in peacekeeping is going to require efforts from both women and men inside and out the UN, including a willingness to challenge our existing ideas about these norms and what gender equity looks like. The introduction and continuation of the FFPU represents an alternative approach. It includes policies and practices that give serious attention to women's needs and motivations. And while this approach is not perfect, nor does it perfectly meet the end goal that the UN stated of women and men working together side by side to ensure peace and security, it's a timely measure that pragmatically seeks to pursue long-term goals while working with available options in the short term. And in doing so, it may enhance security for women and men in the here and now.
Thanks so much, Leslie. It's good that you mentioned gender mainstreaming as quite a vague and abstract concept, even in the UN, because the DFAT official this afternoon told me that that was the Australian approach, gender mainstreaming. Well, I'd like to introduce Professor Sharon Pickering now from the School of Political and Social Inquiry at Monash. And Sharon's going to shift us a little bit closer to home and to crossing borders, which we're all so familiar with. Thank you, Sharon.
Okay, I'm using a new presentation format tonight, so it's a bit like I'm going to try driving on the wrong side of the road. Okay, so I'm just going to ask you to forgive me for any glitches. I am going to take you closer to home, but I'm probably going to start a little bit far away. My focus this evening, I don't think I really need it, on women, peace and security is really to be concerned with the Security Council recognition of the disproportionate and unique impact of armed conflict on women. Our work at the Border Observatory is specifically concerned with how this impact often drives and shapes irregular migration and a failure, a profound failure of states like Australia to effectively respond when women take matters into their own hands, cross borders and seek a secure outcome for them and for their families. It is important to remember that gender and refugee protection and more broadly irregular migration is not part of the Security Council mandate, so it is formally absent from the Women, Peace and Security agenda, its national adoption and indeed action plans. Yet we know damn well that the gendered impact of conflict features in the causes of irregular migration. When women cross borders, they increasingly come into direct contact with measures of the global north to effectively close those borders to all but the most privileged travellers. Over the past decade, women are making up an increasing proportion of irregular migrants globally. This is despite the fact that UNHCR holds firm that refugee women and girls account for about 48% of the refugee population, and they maintain that has remained stable over the past decade. Yet what we are seeing is an increase in the numbers of those women who are seeking asylum, that is, unwilling or unable to remain proximate to countries of origin or wait behind in refugee camps. They are on the move. In Australia, we've seen a jump in the number of female asylum seekers from 12% in 2008-09 to 17% in 2011-12, up to estimates of around 30% in the past 12 months. Moreover, women are making up an increasing proportion of irregular migration populations in both the US and in Europe that do not seek an asylum outcome. So we cannot be concerned with the women, peace and security agenda without taking account of what happens when women arrive at the edges of the global north, as well as what happens to them along the way. Social science research is being undertaken at the Border Observatory at Monash is particularly concerned with understanding what happens between women's experiences of conflict and that seeking and gaining of protection outside their country of origin. So to do so, we're specifically interested in the journeys women make from conflict. Now, on the one hand, this includes the very everyday experiences of violence in relation to the illicit and unregulated spaces that an irregular migrant needs to travel in, and the highly gendered nature of the violence, including sexual violence, arbitrary detention and expulsion. And on the other hand, the ways that border securitisation often fuels that violence and makes it more difficult for women to access security and safety. So the kind of research that we do is located on a range of borders around the world. Now, across these various sites, very different sites, I would add, we ask different but related questions. We ask questions about what makes a border crossing experience of women different to other women and indeed to men. While inclusive of women's victimisation, we also seek to move beyond this and to really consider the agency that is inherent when women are on the move. Coming from the social sciences and indeed predominantly criminology, we investigate the impact of border security on levels and distributions of harm at the border. And we want to bring empirical rigour to conceptual debates around the construction and negotiation of security and human rights. So the ways that we do this are very heavily informed by what Jackie mentioned before in terms of feminist-informed methods around documenting and analysing both micro and macro approaches to conflicts and irregular migration. But in particular, we're interested in doing so by hearing the diversity of women's voices and in identifying the ways that we can mitigate the harm that they encounter. So we do this so that we can speak between the global and the local questions that really frame all of these debates. But we do so by focusing on irregular migration and border control with both an intellectual and political commitment to making visible in questions that have historically been focused on men on the move and on men manning the borders, or as Tony Abbott noted a couple of days, the rough men on our borders that enable us to sleep well at night. So let me take you through a whistle-stop tour of some of the research that we're doing and how we think it intersects with this agenda on women, peace and security. So first up, let me talk a little bit, and I'm going to be talking about some people who are actually in this room this evening. Some of them are over there and some of them are over here, and I hope you get an opportunity to talk to them later on. On the US-Mexico border, Dr. Gabriela Sanchez has been examining the ways that women make decisions regarding the levels of risk and safety surrounding their extra-legal border crossings and their use of the service of human smugglers. Her research has found that there's a need to integrate women's own initiatives to achieve human security rather than conceiving of states and indeed, you know, non-state actors as the only or main providers of human security that they can access. Importantly, her work has featured in some public debates around our own borders here in Australia recently about trying to move beyond the economic perspective around smuggling as simply a transaction and a business, if we actually put women's experiences at the heart of that study. All of this research is also written up online, so you can access more detail about that. In the UK, May Nawu, who unfortunately can't be here this evening, has been working on the provision of victim support to victims of trafficking there. Many victims are identified from regions experiencing high levels of conflict where women have not been equally involved in economic recovery. Trafficking, as many of you would be well aware, is a common form of gendered violence in post-conflict societies, often compounding the gendered violence experienced during conflict. Her research has identified the problematic processing of victims of trafficking and the rubbery relationship with asylum processes, which increasingly do not work to the advantage of women in question. Increasingly, unfortunately, a story we've heard before, repatriation to home countries seems to be one of the few options consistently pursued. Brandy Cochran, who is here this evening, is examining how border hardening in criminology, this concept of target hardening, is an important one. It's unnecessarily sexual, I know, but I'll run with it anyway. But looking at the idea of how border hardening in the EU and indeed in Australia is affecting pregnant women who migrate irregularly. Now, this, of course, relates to the Women, Peace and Security agenda by further contextualising the gendered experiences of those who are fleeing armed combat. And it's seeking to contribute to a better understanding of the agenda, including protecting against the derogation of rights of pregnant migrants and preventing these violations both before and during migration. Now, emerging findings from Brandy's research suggest that border hardening compromises the maternal health of women who migrate regularly. And since pregnancy is increasingly identified to be a catalyst for women in conflict to migrate, the severe circumstances of irregular travel in the face of border hardening is impacting miscarriage rates, affecting impacts on the future health of unborn children, and conclusively altering morbidity rates of pregnant women crossing borders. We're finding very similar findings in the work done by Francesco Vecchio on Lampedusa, particularly women who have fled up through North Africa, through Libya, who have been detained and tortured during detention there. Dr. Alison Gerard has been working with women who have fled conflict in Somalia, travelled through North Africa, intending to seek protection in Italy, and instead becoming trapped on the island state of Malta under EU arrangements to have southern states of the Union contain the threat of irregular migration on behalf of European nations. Her research has been able to identify both the structural and opportunistic determinants of gendered violence during periods of exit, transit and arrival. Her work has highlighted the difficulties for women in accessing economic and social development in Somalia and during flight, their experiences of systemic sexual violence. Indeed, one of her findings of her work was that the systematic rape of women was used as a currency of exchange for male travellers to access through particular geographic areas. In Greece, I'm working with my colleagues Andriani Philly and Mary Bosworth from Oxford University on an ethnographic study of immigration detention there. We've been able to identify and document the highly gendered and racialised approaches to immigration detention that have seen increasing numbers of women repeatedly detained, released, apprehended and again detained in a cycle marked by systemic human rights abuses. Working with border police, the research was able to identify the ways that border control too often reduced women fleeing conflict and deprivation to subhuman status, often relegating women culturally and economically to the status of animals and slaves. Their designation as prostitutes, ironically in a state where sex work is legal, was used to excuse the efforts of state agents and others in their appalling treatment in detention. This effectively meant that the system, a system in a state of collapse, I would note, was unable and unwilling to respond not only to the legal needs around protection, but also survival needs and basic recognition of women's human dignity. Bodine Edwards is documenting and examining the experiences of Tibetan women and Buddhist nuns on the Nepalese border. Given the complexity and barriers associated with leaving the country legally, the available evidence suggests there has been a consistent flow of illegal border crossings in this region. Moreover, Tibetan refugees captured attempting to cross this border experience indeterminate periods of detention, physical and sexual abuse, and are often repatriated. Cyrical, who is here this evening, has just begun work on a fantastic project working with women from Laos on their experiences of vulnerability in policing when irregularly working in Thailand. Her work in the border region highlights the importance of effective regulation for women economically driven to migrate following the failure of social and economic development to deliver for women the kinds of financial and other security needs that they have. Their exposure to unpredictable policing practices of their labour and migration status in the northeast of Thailand is both based on and further compromises their lack of social status in that region. Kurdish women, many born in Iraq and fled to Iran, unable to return or survive in Iran, are increasingly seeking protection in Australia. The impact of sanctions on Iran shapes this experience, but so does the ongoing failure for these women to access any durable solutions inside that state. In addition, Iranian women targeted by the regime or families targeted by the regime also have increasingly few ways to seek protection. As visa restrictions have effectively shut their access to the EU, they have sought out Australia to lodge protection claims. The research that I'm conducting seeks to identify women's decision-making independent of, as well as part of, families. In particular, the ways that conflict, experiences of transit and information consumption patterns impact their decisions about when, where and how to seek protection. In short, to be able to identify the ways that women make decisions about getting on those boats. This research has found evidence of changing social mores, that women are increasingly unwilling to remain behind in Iran and be sent for once a husband is settled or fathers have established themselves elsewhere. Moreover, it's women are increasingly telling me they don't want to stay behind, not in their parents' home and not in the home of their in-laws. It's also finding that gender inequalities, particularly in relation to participation in education and the economy, are increasingly key drivers for women seeking protection. This seeming intractability of the relationship between Iran and the West has not sufficiently extended to reconsidering the ways irregular migration and asylum can be managed in accordance with the basic mechanisms and frameworks for human rights. Women's decision-making as active agents in fleeing persecution not only seeks to identify women's victimisation during flight, but to recognise the importance of their agency in negotiating and realising their security needs. Back here in Melbourne, Rebecca Powell, who's in the audience, is working with us in relation to the ways, this is work that Brandy's worked on as well, that the risks of fleeing conflict and seeking protection are not evenly distributed. As countries of the global north close down safe routes and border crossings, women are increasingly undertaking environmentally hazardous journeys. The shutting down of borders is usually referred to in Australia as deterrence. How it works is like a funnel. It works like a funnel here, it works like a funnel on the US-Mexico border, it works like a funnel around the edges of the EU. It funnels border crossers into increasingly more hazardous border crossing points. During such crossings, our research has found that women are far more likely to die than men. The Border Deaths Database, which Beck maintains, is the only publicly available cumulative record of border-related deaths in Australia. From this database, we can track and trend the ways that women die, not only crossing from Indonesia to Australia, but also in immigration detention, during apprehension and deportation. As the response to conflict, the hardening of borders has a direct and measurable impact on the numbers, how and where women die attempting to cross borders. The bipartisan support of the so-called PNG solution has been identified by Jackie and others as seriously compromising women, as well as Australian aid arrangements and causing ongoing reputational damage. But most important among these is the failure of such measures to effectively respond to women fleeing conflict. At the root of women's irregular migration is the inequitable distribution of resources for the women of the world. This is fundamentally shaped by experiences of conflict and failures of peace building to sufficiently account for and respond to women's needs. Moreover, the actions of many states at the borders of the global north exacerbate the risk and insecurity that many women face. To better understand and respond, we need tenacious yet well-calibrated research that can move between the pressing macro and micro issues that shape conflict and the irregular migrations it spawns. Securing peace for many women depends on the capacity to access and negotiate their individual and familial safety, often a long way from their countries of origin. Our research seeks to build a robust evidence base so that policymakers, advocates, and women worldwide can advocate for the kinds of change that women need. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sharon. I guess for all the reasons that you've just listed, that's why we need women at the peace table. And I think your research and the work of the researchers at the Border Observatory really shows us the continuum of gendered violence within and across and at the border, and also the potential depth and breadth of the Women, Peace, Security agenda and how we might advance and build on and progress that agenda. So thank you so much. Now it's really time to open the floor and get your response and have a broader discussion about Australian leadership, Australian research, or on the Women, Peace, Security agenda, or whatever you wish to raise here. And if you would just introduce yourself and perhaps where you're coming from, if it's an organisation, or if not, that's fine too.
I'm on Muslim Robson Avery. My question is to Leslie. I'm really interested in your presentation, and I'm just wondering if you've spoken to these all women peacekeeping groups and whether they feel they're a great success or what their feedback is.
I might just take a couple of comments first, and then we can return to the panel. 40.
So I think I'm late with Thomas Word. One of the things that that happened after the gang rape in Delhi last year was this idea that, you know, people talked about whether we could have policing, female policing units in India. You're aware, most of us are aware, the cultural aspects are really, really strong in India. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how there was resistance to a lot of reforms, you know, the rape bill came out, and that wasn't very good either. I mean, feminists have been complaining a lot. With these peacekeepers, there is some research, and I'm aware of Marsha Henry's work in this aspect, where she's kind of talks their cultural aspects in which these women who are deployed aren't even aware of the culture, but they kind of have a very distant idea of what Liberian culture is, and the way they engage with the women is always in this mode of othering. They're constantly looking at Liberia as, you know, like the social mores are different, the interactions are different, and so there's been a bit of a problem with that, and Marshall's written extensively, but I was wondering in your interview if you encountered that and if you had anything.
Is there perhaps another question, and especially, yes, Melissa.
Melissa Monticato from the Australian Institute of International Affairs. The Australian Institute of International Affairs has been working with the Department of Foreign Affairs on civil society. So I suppose my question for all of the people on the panel is, I think you're doing magnificent academic work. How much traction?
Thanks so much, Melissa. I think we'll let Leslie respond and then go to Romney and Sharon, and then we'll open the further questions.
And also I'll be drawing a lot, hopefully, on work of Marsha Whitmore, about some of the work they're doing, but I'm going to go for a short time.
I think that point is really important. I invited Marsha to speak on the peace exploitation and the document. My main response to that would be it's the same as with male peacekeepers. So only that we're not judged in more negatively than the whole range across, is that there's not a lot of cultural sensitivity across the board, and I think, I don't know if this is the case or if it's highlighted more, but it does appear from what you say that they are more engaged with local communities than their male colleagues. Mm-hmm. It could just be a disproportionate media focus. days, done self-defense training, dance classes, and this has all been well reported on. So there is at least some interaction with local communities, which we don't see reported as minor offenses, which may or may not be the case. Also, some research that's been done on militaries has found that women and minority members, this is with U.S. military, were less likely to make racist stereotypes and respond in that way towards the communities that they were displaying racism with, partly because of having experienced negative impacts of being stereotyped and that happens with every individual, but it would be interesting to see.
So, in response to the question, I guess, relating to the relationship between theory and practice, certainly in the international legal world, there has definitely been an impact of scholarship, and even more so the advisor for the International Criminal Tribunal, Paul Wanda, in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, has also had gender advisors with academics, and certainly judges in their judgments often refer to.
I think that's actually the $50 million at the moment. So some of the things that we do, we look to put into international language the kind of the
finance
we try to get that out there and understand policy makers very regularly. Of course, there are two major issues, as many people face in most areas. One that would be relevant to most areas and another perhaps specific to this time. On the one hand, the one that's specific to this area is that the politicisation of asylum in Australia is of an order that often means that evidence is not valued. I think you would find it difficult to find either Tony Burke or Scott Morrison to offer any uncertainty about anything that they are doing, so much so that they might actually consult evidence. So we have a what I call a gulf between the evidence and the politics. That doesn't mean we stop trying to close that gulf, but at the moment let's face it, the gulf is too large. However, I would note a positive note. When you do get it in the hands of policymakers, you can get some good outcomes. But of course, I think one of the most strategic things to do is actually the work of frontline practitioners. I think that's where we get the most traction. And I've done some work with customs, and I think we've got some good outcomes from that. However, I would point out that during the Houston process last year, when I was presenting on the ways that women die at far greater rates during that, the environmental hazardous portion of an irregular migration unit. The way they interpreted that in the report was to remove family reunion. If they thought that by doing that, they didn't want to, they felt that that would be the way to redress that issue. And of course, he tried to put into their hands a lot of evidence that deterrence didn't work, so they talked about incentives and disincentives. That's what they were talking about was deterrence. They simply changed the language. So the question is, what do you do once the evidence is in the hand? And of course, that is a difficult experience. But I think the entire reason the border observership is set up, and I think you'll see similar in relation to the Captain Centre and other similar outlets such as yourself, is to bridge that divide between academic research and policy. And I think on time, at times we'll be really successful, and at times we'll be really unsuccessful, and hopefully most of the time we'll be somewhere in between. But one thing on trust, problematic, long-held, and poorly founded ideas on the
one of the ways that can have an impact, and not just visiting Australian government, but internationally, is by working together.
And often it's easier, I think, as Romney pointed out, to have an impact at the internet and wait till that change occurs there, and then maybe the Australian government will bring it up.
Can I ask you, I'm John Randall from the University of Melbourne, I teach a course on that. I wonder what some of your high priority proposals would be to the government. If you had your wishes, what would you hope that they were going to do in September?
Well, My question is for Sharon Pickering. I'm an honors student looking at asylum seekers in geography and looking at the geography distinction. Many people on the panel noted the ability of security with support protection. My question is now firmly in an area of security policy. In my research, I've noted that there's a lot of conflicting discourse, not only in Australia, but in a lot of other areas, between security and protection. We see it now, the discourse is really about protecting our sea. More than that, that discourse is sort of looking at protecting those women who are coming on the board to meet those families. So my question is, how do we change that narrative in research, in policy discussion, where we don't perpetuate these narratives of vulnerability for women who are making those border populations?
Sharon, another one. I'm Erin from Young Mirror Women. And after studying, looking at the issues that women face in different to men crossing borders, that participation line, how difficult is it to get like, women's voices heard?
The entire focus on that is to talk primarily using the qualitative methodology, but on a large scale. Our entire sample is sitting just across 300. By the end, we should be close to around about 460. So one of the specific issues that we have with voices is that when the serious men of policy sit down, they think the numbers are too small. So part of the rationale for research is to build a number of stats are persuasive in policy. Accessing women who have been through the kinds of experiences that we talk about is not easy. A lot of rolled up sleeves, and you just hang in there. Yes, that's right. The total exploitation of the loss of life for political gain. well, there's something to be said about having longer election cycles. Okay, there is something to be said about what we need to do to move out of that realm of politicisation. But that's the fundamental issue. We know that most of the are always going to be tested, will always be partial, will work for some period of time. What we know is it is much easier to get the evidence to the table. And to have the kinds of discussions that can result in the shifting of that discourse, let's say, that once elections.
Also, within the United Nations generally, the Secretary, other issues besides questions of sexual violence.
Thank you for asking it. Actually, I think that you've got your hand up, Jerry. Some very concrete ideas, and I think they relate to really playing up the importance of a gendered approach to a broader understanding of the conflict in Europe, please, and
specifically
in the
UK. Mayor
Bell,
our specialist
for Australia.
Yeah, thanks. John, great question. If I'd known you in the audience, I would have anticipated you asked that comment. but it's a really important question. I think there's a consolidation for what we're seeing in relation to the UN Security Council at the moment. Sorry, I actually should introduce myself. I'm the CEO of International Women's Development Agency. So safety and security in relation to women's rights and gender equality is one of our three top priorities. I'm quietly hoping to be in New York in a couple of weeks as part of that Pride event, lobbying with my peers from the Pacific, which leads me to the point. We're not alone in the Security Council agenda in relation to women, peace and security. What is really exciting about what's happening in this global dialogue space, which has been such an extraordinary narrow domain in terms of definitions of security, for so long is that there are many nations championing women, peace and security. It's fabulous. And so Australia, in taking the seat and the presidency in September this year and October next year, needs to decide its choice of theme. We've chosen in September the theme of women's leadership in peace building, and those of us in this coalition that includes WIPSAC and a lot of NGO leaders and a lot of political activists, perhaps even bureaucratic activists, have really felt that it's very important that we try to bring our regional focus to this issue. So there is a huge amount of dialogue, both being the penholder and things on countries like Afghanistan and various other areas, very specific analysis and focus on particular peacekeeping operations, missions and so on. We think there's a voice in relation to broader definitions of human security from a woman's perspective, from women's organisational perspective, from civil society perspective, coming across the whole of the Pacific region that is almost invisible and unheard in the UN Security Council. So we're truly hoping we get some of those women leaders, such as Sharon Butler-Miles from Fiji, who leads the Pacific chapter of the Global Partnership Prevention of Armed Conflict in relation to gender. Sister Lorraine Garasau, who is an extraordinary leader in relation to community responses to violence against women in terms of what is both state sanctioned violence but also the whole impunity and what we've seen recently in terms of the Sorcery Act and Witchcraft Act in Papua New Guinea being repealed but then swinging the other way and bringing in the death penalty. We need to have some serious discussions around that. And then finally, I think an example from the Solomon Islands in terms of the experience of the last decade of the Ramsey peacekeeping mission there and all that we've learned with a particularly strong emphasis of Australian leadership. What is our view about that with a gender lens over it? How might we look at that differently in the future in relation to what is integrated responses, but what is actually women's leadership about how you establish those frameworks for peace building in future. So I think that's what we've been lobbying, that's what we've been advocating. We're hoping that we join a global process around this. This is ongoing. But I think our job in that chair is to advocate for our closest neighbours, and that's what we're hoping to do.
Do others want to make any comments on this? The regional focus is really crucial, especially given the what does it mean? How much longer can we put up with transitional? I think countries that have high levels of gender equality like as a kind of key factor actually in preventing.
Thank you. So, Monique Cuffy, I'm the policy unit on Monash Uni. The issue of gender came up, and I wanted to kind of gather your thoughts on our role in the Security Council. Obviously, gender sensitivity is a big issue in the global north. What would you like to see happen, you know, particularly on this issue for both military and peacekeeping operations?
I can keep the government accountable. I can't seem to do it with my vote. It's not enough, given where I live. And I can't change policy because I'm not doing significant research. I'm just wondering for everyone in this room that feels like they don't have a voice in keeping government accountable, how you think you should do this. The other question is for Sharon. I was interested. You said that the numbers of women seeking asylum in Australia have been growing, especially coming from Iran. And I was wondering why they was actually a body that we would also want to be very critical of. because Harvey Democratic is dominated by the P5. They also happen to be the world's largest arms producers. They're not interested in a whole lot of issues, feminist issues, like arms reduction, for example. And so I guess partly to pick up on the last question too, I think it's absolute. I don't think we'd be where we are without the Women's International Recognition Group. But I do think we're not going to get very far unless we have people's movements that remain strong and critical. But certainly, yes, let's celebrate what has been achieved, because I would never have predicted that the Security Council would be a platform for feminist ideas. And it's not so much the platform that's important, but it's creating these kind of links for women on the ground that they can then use to that's important. So that's how I see it anyway. So I'm interested in sort of how we retain a sort of critical edge to which doesn't stop us from proceeding and being optimistic, but keeps us a bit critical.
Agree with what the point or comment was. That's not to say, though, that we shouldn't be optimistic, because it's great that the conversations are taking place and that there is some action happening on the women, peace and security front. In terms of keeping governments accountable, I would say that there are lots of informal ways. Even writing opinion letters to the really everyone has power and everyone can have a voice. Because there are so many to be to a whole lot of people. But lots of people are on Twitter now, and forums like, you know, the conversation and the drum and the news folder and all sorts of forums where you can publish your thoughts without on sex appeal, but I don't think that's what the question was really that directed at. I don't know if you want to repeat that.
I was just kind of interested in what you'd like to say.
We're all muttering, making unfortunate comments, but it's good on the sexism and misogyny that we've been seeing over the last little while in our own backyard. I'm going to dodge that question a little bit. Iranian women are on the move for complicated reasons. However, they are increasingly on the move because other avenues are on the move for study, other avenues from down. They are on the move too because they are unwilling to not only to endure the regime against them and their families, but also, if you like, the layered gendered effects of that. So many women who were talking to me only fled because either they themselves were targets, or their husbands or brothers or sons or were targets, but also because if they worked in a shop, they were told they were no longer. They were told their daughters were no longer going to school. So often it was not only because they were targeted by the regime, it was also layered by the, you know, the social, the cultural, and the economic factors that are being discussed here. So it's what I would suggest is women rarely flee for single reasons. There's often layers of reasons, but they often flee in particular directions because of the way they do or don't allow a regular movement. The reason we've become so focused on borders in Australia and particularly in the EU, we have closed down the avenue for accessing visas for authorised travel. Okay, that is why. And that is why I actually think there's a whole lot of huge things we can do to change. We must remember that there are so many levers for the government to put information to change the way that people cross borders. Okay, we must at the moment. I would say that you've never been in a position to have your voice heard, because you have organisations like WITSAC to get involved with the amount of research internships, and I'll give a plug for the Border Observatory. We get people involved, and lots of other organisations around. We want people involved, so that not only we can learn and see what. But what we've been trying to do is to really to be able to focus and energy, and also to really highlight the importance that we're able to produce, you know, next generation of critical thinkers, and of course, we work in university, so in particular I have on here, importance of robust, independent research is really important. And so I think becoming involved with that, on top of all the ways that we are so much better connected and so better able to be aware and to pivot between the experiences of the world, we're so much better able now to what is our place in all of this, and how can involved, and I would just say finally to Guy's question, how do we remain critical? We keep talking to the people in our perspective. We're sitting down and we're talking to the most effective way, we don't lose the critical edge.
Well, I'm going to close up, but I do want to have my 2 cents worth. And I always found the concept guide, feminist, utopian, realist, particularly good kind of combination. And the question of how you can be an active citizen and how you can hold your government accountable, let me count the ways. Join WIPSAC, join Young Wilts, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which will be 100 years old next year, and which has a of changing the world. I think it is the most exciting time. If I kind of trace my adult life, when we lived in the Cold War, in a bipolar system, and everybody said that, you know, that was just how it is, and if you wanted to study international relations, you better be studying nuclear deterrence. And look at the change. And by the way, the change did not come from presidents or elites in government. I wrote my PhD on Eastern European citizens. Working together, collaborating across boundaries, and struggling every day to bring about a change and to make peace. And I always kind of hold in the back of my head a few different quotes. One might be from Antonio Gramsci, who wrote from prison. Reporters have the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the will. That's a good combination. And you can achieve that by working with our colleagues in civil society and within universities. I love the quote from Mandela, "Be the change that you want to see in the world." Okay? And the very same idea came from a positive from Fort Czechoslovakia under really, the most rigid communist race, totalitarian regime, and Havel talked about living in truth, living as you want the world to be every day. And I think that there are so many people doing that now, and there are so many opportunities to connect through social media, through universities, through civil society organizations, that you can hold your government accountable. It may not be just its policies anymore, but you definitely have many opportunities. Not just as an individual, but really collectively. So thank you everybody for your contributions tonight, and I've really given the drinks and the hors d'oeuvres a short shrift. So please join us.